Hey guys, and we are back here in Canada. It might still be a little bit cold out here, but it is spring, and we don't really get summer until June around these parts. But anyways, we are ready to get going. This month, we are talking about one of the oldest style lens mounts out there, and that is using just regular threads, the M42, M39, or Leica thread mount. So, let's hit it.
Coming to you live from Toronto, Canada, this is the Classic Camera Revival. If you don't have gear acquisition syndrome now, you certainly will after listening to our show.
So, before there were bayonets, there were just regular screw mount cameras, and this was pretty much a universal system for 35mm SLRs. It wasn't until you got into the bayonet mounts that you really started to see camera systems get specialized. So there are a lot of really great cameras out there that use it. Of course, you have the Barnack Leicas and the various other rangefinders of the area. And also, the M42 was made famous through the Pentax Spotmatic series. So we are going to get started with something from east of the Iron Curtain. And that would be the Praktika.
Ooh, the wonderful Praktika. It's probably one of the most simplest cameras that I have in when it comes to 35mm SLRs. I mean, it's fully mechanical, absolutely no possibility of using a battery because, well, there's no electronics whatsoever on it other than the wonderful hot shoe. That's it. That's all it's got. One hot shoe, 1 second through to 1/1000th of a second plus bulb. But the only thing that I find really odd about my particular model, the L2, I'm not sure if it's on the L. I've never had any kind of experience with the L. But the L2 had no lock in between exposure. So when you wound on the film and cocked the shutter, you could do it again and again and again and again all the way through your entire roll of film, and it'll just keep going. It just doesn't stop. However, at the same time, that actually does make it a little bit better when you're loading it. You just wind to one, and you're set and you're ready to go. There also is an indicator in the viewfinder to let you know when the shutter has been fired and when it is cocked. I can't remember if it shows a pointer when it's been exposed or when it's cocked. I really can't remember right now. And either way, it is an interesting way it works, but seems a little redundant when they could have just put an advance lock on it, which makes no sense why there isn't. I don't understand why you advance and then you can keep going. Of course, this design was built upon from the L. They went to the L2. There was also the LLC, which the LLC is kind of a rather interesting camera because it is the first camera to have open aperture metering.
Really?
Really, really.
Huh.
And Pentax picked that up with the Spotmatic F, and they had a lever inside that would work with certain lenses, such as the Super Multi-Coated Takumar, which has the communication lever inside that tells the camera what aperture it's set to, and eventually this switched to the K-mount.
Okay. Nice. Nice.
Loading the Praktika, it's a little bit of a pain in the butt. Just the way it's the loading mechanism is on it. And then right by the sprocket counter wheel, although it's not really a counter, it's just for the advance of the film, they've put a shield over it. It's supposed to make it easier to load. You slide the film in through there, advance it, and then the take-up spool has these metal arms that are supposed to grab the film. I've never once had it work. I've tried loading it several times. Finally, I just get fed up and just slide the film through, bend it over one of the arms, and then advance and hope it grabs. And most times that method works. But hoping the film grabs it, or the camera grabs the film itself, I just find it's flimsy and it pops off. I have a feeling it's got something to do with the extra long leader that you usually had with Leica when you were loading the Barnacks and stuff like that. I think that was the sort of design that was with this one. Just the way it worked was with extra long leader, But with the modern film, you don't have as long a leader. You have a very short little stub. And I don't think that was quite as common back in the early 70s when the L2 was released.
Okay.
Can I jump in on that?
Because absolutely.
I bought a Praktika as sort of a rear lens cap for the Tessar lens, and it had that same kind of loading.
Okay.
It just doesn't work.
No, it doesn't. Not at all. I've never had it work.
So, like I said, the camera is a rear lens cap, so I don't really care, but it's not just you. There's something fundamentally wrong with that design.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
In all honesty, there is one good thing that I will tell about this Praktika is that in cold weather, it still works. Every single frame works. Plus, you don't have to worry about the foam seals breaking down because they used yarn.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
It's a Russian camera.
Well, east of the wall. It's German.
Sorry.
Close enough. It's communist.
Come, take my Praktika.
Well, staying east.
Now we have to pay royalties.
Yeah. Not for that much. Well, staying east of the wall, this is a camera that is one that is familiar to a couple of us here at the table.
The Zenit, my first camera ever. And
that would be the Zenit E. One of my first SLRs that I actually got was a Zenit B, which is, again, just a meterless version of the Zenit E. I like this camera. I really do. It's incredibly simple to use. It's bulletproof. The shutters can fail in them, but then again, given the age of the camera itself, and considering where it came from, not really surprised. The one thing that everyone will probably immediately recognize on this camera is the lens, and that is the infamous Helios lens.
You're not worthy.
Thank you.
Wow, we are such nerds.
No surprise there. When I got my Zenit B, I bought it at a garage sale. It actually had the Helios lens. I ended up trading it for a K1000, not knowing what I had at the time. What's really nice about these cameras, and I have a bit of a love-hate relationship with Russian cameras, but...
You love to hate them?
Yeah. Or they love to hate me. But the Zenit E is the one Russian camera that I actually really enjoy using simply because of its simplicity, its bulletproof nature, and the fact that it'll work even without a battery. You do need a mercury cell battery in this to operate the meter. That, I feel, is the one weak point. Yeah. I don't know where it goes, but...
No, it's...
Is it a selenium?
It's selenium.
Oh.
I know this because it was my first camera.
Ah, yes.
The only weak point? I could probably name another one.
Well,
the body is junk.
Yes.
But easy to repair.
Very easy to repair, but that was the mark of quality for a Russian camera, if it could be repaired by the average person. That was the mark of quality within the communist regime.
It can be repaired with a sledgehammer and a slot screwdriver.
Absolutely. The meter is uncoupled, so you can't... you can sort of take the reading, and then you have to translate it. You have to manually stop down the lens. There's no communication between there. And, like rangefinders of the era, you can't change the shutter speed unless you cock the shutter. And thankfully, this one, despite the fact that I have a Cyrillic nameplate on mine, it does have the DIN scale on it, which, unfortunately, because we don't have any film these days that use the GOST scale anymore, the DIN is there for a little bit extra help. It's just an absolutely fantastic camera. Great as a beginner mechanical camera if you can find one that works. And with an M42 lens mount, you can get Zeiss glass for it.
Or you can get inexpensive Zeiss glass because it has the Pentacon logo on it.
That's right.
Or get a Helios 44-2.
Which is Zeiss glass.
They mostly
waste your money and get a Biotar.
Yeah, that too. But yeah, the Zenit D, great little camera to pick up. They're dirt cheap on the used market, if you can find one that works.
I paid $15 for the body for one of them. I had two of them.
You paid $15?
Yeah. $15.
My condolences, you overpaid.
It came with the Helios.
Yeah.
Still overpaid.
You paid for the lens.
I paid for the lens.
Yep. Makes a great camera for International Communist Camera Day, which is coming up next month.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah.
Is that on May Day?
Absolutely.
Da Tavarish.
Yeah. May Day.
So we're moving to another occupied nation now. We are going to Japan, and James has a really fun rangefinder that I've had the honor of using and never actually knew existed, and that's the Yashica YF.
Yeah, so this is a very unique camera. This camera came about around 1959. It's an interchangeable lens rangefinder. It was produced by Yashica. They introduced it right after they absorbed a small little camera company called Nikka. And this camera was based on the Nikka 3L.
I thought it looked familiar. I've seen the Nikkas.
Yeah.
I thought for sure that was a Nikka just by the body design. Yeah.
You know, one of the big reasons why this camera is kind of obscure these days, they launched it just when rangefinders were kind of losing a lot of market share.
That's
so,
right.
So SLRs were, you know, at the late 50s, early 60s, SLRs were starting to be introduced into the marketplace. The Nikon F was launched at the same time this camera was launched. So you know who won that battle. So basically, you know, after Yashica acquired the Nikka company, they had rebranded their Nikka 3L, which was an attempt to copy the Leica M3, but with M39 mount. So this is a Leica thread mount, basically. As I mentioned, it was introduced in the U.S. just when the Nikon F came out. So, you know, that basically put it on the market for about 1 year, and then it went away. And I'll talk a little bit about the value a little bit further in the discussion and what kind of deal I got on this camera. And it's the best find ever for me, personally.
It's not the first camera that I know of that Yashica's copied the name of for market value, because they also did the same thing with one of their Electros, the M5.
Well, that's possible. But keep in mind, Yashica didn't copy this camera. They bought Nikka, and then they created this camera as a result of that acquisition. So,
I just mean simply on names, because the Electro M5 shares nothing with Leica's M5, because the Yashica's version is complete.
Oh yeah, yeah,
junk.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, and well, I mean, there's quite a few cameras that have had that similar experience, having to change their names because Leica got cheesed off at something. There's another one besides Yashica. It escapes my memory right now, but
well, there's always the Minolta Maxim with the XX that Exxon went after.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
Also, Leica had a beef with Olympus when they introduced the M1,
right,
which
it
became the OM1.
That's it. That's right. It was Olympus, yeah.
And if you see an M1 out there, grab it, because
they're rare.
They're rare.
Yeah, as is the Yashica YF. So this camera is an excellent camera, by the way. It's got a really, really good finder. It has parallax correction between 50 and 100, and it's got Yashica's bright line frame lines, which makes it really, really easy to use. It's probably better, I think, than any of the earlier knob rewind Leicas in terms of usability and loadability. certainly better than the Canon rangefinders before the Canon 7 came out, for sure. Ironically, today, the Nikka's second class cheaper finish starts looking pretty damn good when you put it next to an M6, and I have one here for effect. And considering this M6 was made in my particular one was manufactured in 97. The YF was manufactured in 1959. That camera's held up pretty damn good.
Yeah.
You can actually see quite a resemblance in body design between the two.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The Yashica, it has that look of quality. It doesn't look like a cheap camera.
It's certainly not a cheap camera, and we'll talk about how not cheap it is. As you mentioned, it's got a very, very strong influence. Lever rewind on the back door looks very much like an M3, built on a screw mount body, basically. It's basically it's got the same typical Barnack type shutter. as well. One interesting thing about the camera, the frame lines, although not marked in this camera, if you just use the outer frame, it's a 35 millimeter frame line. I only have the one lens for this camera, and it's a Yashin on 1.8 f5, and it's rumored that Nikkor actually made this lens. And Nikon was making a lot of the M39 lenses at this time, mm-hmm. that for their rangefinder, which surpassed a lot of the Leica glass as
I
well.
I thought the images that I got out of it looked familiar.
Yeah.
And on the resolving power and how the out of focus elements looked, I'm like, recognize that. That looks Nikon.
Yeah, like if you were to acquire like an S1 or an S2, you with a Nikkor, you know, 1.8 on it or 1.8, I think 1.7 they might have made. But anyways, you'll find that the image quality is pretty much identical.
Yeah.
And this, at 25% of the cost of one of those cameras is pretty damn good. Interesting, from a usability standpoint, there's two shutter speed dials on the camera. There is a low speed, so a 1/30th to, or 1 second to 1/60th. There's a low speed setting on the body, on the front of the camera, and then the high speed setting from 60 to 1000 on the top of the camera. So pretty interesting way they've gone about it. But a lot of cameras of that era had dual speed dials. This one has simple PC flash sync. No complicated flash settings or anything like that that you would see in like a Leica 3F or 3G. There is no hot shoe, so... the film counter on this camera has to be manually reset. Very similar again to the M2s. This is very much, rather than a copy of the early M's, this is kind of like, well, let's grab all the M's and see where they screwed up and see what we can do to kind of, refine it a little bit. So, it's about the same size as both of those cameras. It's a little bit larger on the top plate than the M3 or M2. The frame counter is it's a bit of a pain that you have to rewind it manually. The good thing about this camera that's nicer than the older Barnack Leicas is the back door flips open, so it's very, very easy to use.
And you don't have to trim the leader to get it loaded properly.
You do not.
Thank goodness.
No, it's a very easy camera.
It's not a bottom loader?
No. It is. It's a bottom
loader. It's a bottom
loader. You don't need to trim the leader.
Yeah.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah. The
I think I might want to try that thing one of these days.
It's,
that thing looks actually like a lot of fun to
it's a great
to shoot with.
If you take a look, like they put a lot of ergonomic refinements into this camera compared to the earlier Barnack style. Like the film advance, like look at the size of the thumb lever and the throw's not too bad.
No.
You know.
And it's
single stroke too.
And it's right there.
It's right there. Yeah. Yeah, it's very good. Shutter release button. Really nice and big.
Yep.
Easy to push. A lot of really good refinements. Now, this camera, interesting story about how I acquired this camera from our main pusher, which is Joan over at Burlington Camera.
Joan.
So, you know, I'm in there, you know, in my, you know, shall we say, cyclical emptying of the bank account trip.
I was there with you, was I not?
When I bought this, I'm not sure.
I'm trying to remember.
Anyway, I had gone in there and I said to John, I said, hey, like, I'm looking for an interesting, you know, rangefinder. Is there anything that you have? So she said, oh, you know, I just got some stuff that come in, I guess, you know, from their usual trolling of estate and garage sales, etc. So she showed me this Yashica YF, and it was pretty beaten up. And I have some before and after pictures of how I restored this camera that I can give to you, Alex, and hopefully we can put them in the show notes.
Absolutely.
So the lens was seized, and the body was filthy, but all superficial.
Yeah.
So I basically got the lens off the screw mount. It was just screwed on tightly, that's all.
Yep.
And I cleaned it up. And I took the top off. I buffed it as much as I could. I took out a few little dents and dings. I paid $75 for this camera. And while I was still in the store, and to Joan's credit, I'll give her certainly huge points for integrity as a camera dealer. She said I could have it for $75, and then I'm not sure what's the name of the website that we. Anyway, we'll figure it out. But there's a website that you can go on that tracks the market value of all of these cameras. And we'll get it. We'll put it in the show notes. But anyway, she popped onto that website, and the camera in this condition, as it sits now, is about $800 or $900 US. Yep. And she's showed that to me. She said, "I told you 75. I'm going to stick to the 75."
And that's why we keep going back to Joan.
Yeah. So if you are ever in the Greater Toronto area and are looking for, and we don't plug too many people, we plug really good people on this show,
such as Argentix,
Joe Vieira for your Hasselblad service. Mm-hmm.
Basically, anything that is really, really dedicated to film, you can pretty much guarantee,
or you know what, a bit of a even that, like, just dedicated to the photographer.
Oh, absolutely. You know,
as a dealer, and understanding that this stuff is expensive and people use their hard-earned money to buy these things and have fun with them. She doesn't gouge. She, prices are fair. And she said, you know what, I said you could have it for $75. You can have it for $75, and I hadn't even paid for it yet. The sale wasn't even finalized. Yep. But for me, this is the first time I've ever made money buying a camera. Unlike Alex Laux in the corner over there, who seems to have the luck of the entire island of Ireland.
But we're not bitter.
We're not bitter at all.
We're
mildly jealous.
Yes, we are. We're extremely bitter.
The wonderful thing about Joan is also her customer service. She knows what we like, sort of thing. And that's if you call ahead and say, hey, I'm looking for something like this, she'll actually call you later on and say, hey, I've got this. Do you want me to hold it? Do you want to come by and take a look at it and stuff?
Yeah.
And she knows the models that we like and the cameras that we like and always gives us a fair price, be it if we're buying and or selling, actually.
Yeah, but I have to say, one thing to take away from this is if you're into rangefinders and the optical quality that you get from rangefinders, and you're willing to put up with the usability of a rangefinder, and you've always wanted a Leica, and, it seems far away because, it's a lot of money to invest in something that has a little red dot on it.
Well, let's be fair. I mean, when we're talking about a Leica, we're not talking about the Barnax, the old bottom loaders. We're talking about the more refined M series of Leica.
But if you're looking for, like, say, an M3, that's going to run you about, let's say, $1,200 just for a body.
Yeah.
For $800 or $900, you can get this camera, which is basically an M3. I think an M3, a refined M3, with better optics for, two-thirds of the cost.
And it probably includes the lens as well.
And this would include the lens for that $900. Like, this is a better lens than or equivalent to a Summicron 50.
Yep.
Blasphemy.
Yashinon was Yashica's top-level lens throughout its history.
So I would urge anyone, if you can find one, and there are two on eBay right now that I saw.
Yeah.
One selling for $899 that comes with...
There's two lenses, I think, a 50 and a 35. And
it came with two and a meter, too, as well.
Oh, that's right.
Then there's another one there for maybe $700.
Yeah.
So if anyone is looking for one of these and want to try it out, there's two pretty good examples out there on Fleabay right now. So anyway, I love this camera, and I'd recommend it to anyone to give it a shot.
Absolutely.
I can definitely vouch for Yashinon glass. I had have a Yashinon 50 F2, and when I traded it to John, I instantly had regrets trading that lens to him. But thankfully, a wonderful friend of mine in the U.S., Mike Novak, tossed it in a box for me and shipped it up my way. So thankfully, I've got another chrome nose Yashinon 50 F2. They're wonderful lenses. Absolutely phenomenally good lenses.
Okay, and sticking with the Yashica, we have an SLR model from them, and John's going to talk about that.
Yep, this is the Yashica TL Electro. This is the Yashica at the table that does not have a resale value of $800. But this camera is very special to me because this is my first SLR. I bought this with the help of my parents in 1977 when I was somewhat younger. And I shot hundreds of rolls of film with this, mainly black and white because that's all I could afford. Shot it up until the birth of my first daughter. So the first, sort of the last roll of film that I shot in it for quite a number of years was my elder daughter's baby pictures, and she'll be 24 tomorrow. So that was a while ago.
Wow.
The camera itself, it's an obvious ripoff of the Spotmatic in terms of the form factor, the usability. It's a pretty primitive camera. It does have a meter, CDS meter, but the metering is stopped down. Like the lens itself is automatic, so you're only stopping down for the meter. It is match needle. However, one thing that's sort of interesting for the period is it's not an analog meter inside the finder. It's sort of an upper LED and a lower LED. You turn until both LED show displayed. I can't speak English today. And it still works. That I had to get some kind of fake battery because it's from the Mercury era.
Right. So
not the space program, but the
but the batteries.
Yeah. PX625?
It's been so long. But you're
running a wine cell in it? Yeah.
It wasn't a wine cell. It's something
Zinc air.
Something I'll have to take the that off and have a look.
We'll take a peek.
The other good thing about this camera is that the speed settings were like intermediate, so you could stop halfway in between.
Nice.
It didn't have to go from 125 to 250. The viewfinder is not particularly bright. Like it's a fairly basic SLR, but for a kid who was 15 years old and wanted to learn, I think this is a really, really good way to go. All I had for 3 years, I had a 50mm lens. The lens itself now is sort of, it was a Yashinon, but it's basically seized. That lens needs some work. But it's not bad, to start off with one camera, one lens, and you can learn a lot going that way. I got it out a couple of years ago again. The seals are pretty gummy. It needs work. But and sometimes the meter switch is a bit cranky, but it works. But the thing is this would be the last camera I'd sell because it ties me to my late parents.
Yeah.
And this has had one owner, and it will go to it will only ever have one owner until I croak.
Nice.
Oh, and a thing for I threw on a Tessar 2.8 50, the Carl Zeiss Jena. Amazing lens I got for next to nothing.
Oh yeah.
And that's just the great thing about the universality of the screw mount is you can mix and match till the cows come home.
Absolutely.
I thought that lens kind of looked familiar because I'm looking at the design of my Pentacon 51.8 that I've got on my Praktika.
Yep.
And you can literally see pretty much a nearly identical design.
Oh yeah.
Yep. This one's a bit more rounded, so I think it's closer to it's a complete rip off of the Spotmatic look and feel.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. Definitely. TL Electro is 100%.
If you're used to shooting with a Spotmatic, you could pick this up and your fingers would go to the exact same places because the controls are in the same place.
Yeah.
Well, they couldn't have picked a better camera to copy because Spotmatic, that you pick one of those up and it just feels like you've come home.
You know how to use it. Absolutely. Yep. Staying in Occupied Japan, a camera that is no stranger to this podcast, we have Bill with the Canon P.
The Canon Populaire. This used to be John's camera, and then it became my camera. And I sort of wound up selling the Canon 51.8 Serenar lens back to John and winding picking up a later 51.8 from the 60s. It is a fun rangefinder. Now, I shoot Leica M as well. I own an M3 that was my dad's and an M4II that I bought off my brother. So I'm no stranger to rangefinder. And the Canon P is, if you want to get into rangefinder photography, Soviet cameras just aren't your jam. I highly recommend looking for a Canon P or Populaire. It was considered the budget camera of the day, but in fact, it's built like a truck. It's extremely durable. There are a few things you can adjust. They've even got a little screw you can adjust the rangefinder into an alignment. It's got frame lines for 35, 50, and 100. And I have a 35-2.5 color Scopar screw mount lens from Voigtlander. I've also got the 51-4 Japanese Sumilux, which actually lives on my M4-2. And I'm on the hunt for a 100 3.5 Canon lens somewhere out there. Makes a great 50th birthday present, kids. Think about it. My birthday's coming up in a few months. Now, in terms of usability...
Do you have kids you don't know about? What's going on?
No.
Exactly.
I'm hoping some generous viewers, listeners out there in podcast land, one can dream. Anyway...
See, some podcasts have giveaways. and like some podcasts have giveaways. We're trying the reverse.
Exactly.
Yes. Give me's.
Yeah, please. Anyway, unlike my M body rangefinders from Leica, the Canon P is much easier to load. You could just open the back up. And in fact, it's got like sort of almost secure. So the secure elements to it, so the back won't pop open on its own by accident, which, you know, use any other camera, sometimes that's known to happen. And
I've had that happen on a Zenit. I thought it was locked, and sure enough, I look down, and there it is. My film back's wide open, exposing my T-Max 400 to noon daylight. Thank you. Oops. Thank you, Zenit.
Thank you to the Russian or Ukrainian designers who...
I believe his name is Igor.
Yeah, Igor or Vladimir.
His name is either Igor or Viktor.
A little too much vodka.
Anyway, getting back to the P, is an extremely easy camera to use. I just use it with a 50 lens. I've used it mostly urban shooting in Toronto. It could also make a great travel camera as well. You want it to, of course, it has no meter at all. So if you're not versed to a Sunny 16, you've got a couple of options. A handheld
meter.
And
you're listening to the wrong podcast.
Yeah.
Totally.
Moving right along. So if you need meters, well, you got the clip-on Voigtlander meter, if you can find one, or alternately a handheld meter like a Siconic L398A. Which requires no batteries at all.
Yeah, or Gosson Luna 6F Pro.
Yeah, either or, and you're set to go. And the
guys, come on, let's be honest. We live in the 2000s. I guess it's almost 2020. We've got phones. We've got light meter apps. Granted, yes, but in a pinch, if you don't have a handheld light meter on you, and you happen to be out with a mechanical, or you just picked one up, well. You know what? There you go. Perfect. You got your phone, throw a light meter app on there, and it should get you within range enough for the film's latitude to pick it up.
Exactly. Anyway, in terms of cost, if you're looking for a Canon P, they're bouncing around. Actually, I've seen Canon 7s, the first line of the Canon 7s, go on eBay from Japanese sellers for about $150. Of course, shipping's on top of that. That's just for the body. So the Canon P is about the same, and of course, you're going to have to buy a lens separately as well. So budget in another $200, $250 if you want to keep it within the Canon family.
But if you're Russian and save a little bit of
coin. Or you can get a Jupiter 8 and hope for the best.
You get a 0.9550, which was designed for this camera as well, wasn't it?
That was for the 7.
Because it had a special mount.
Oh, that's right. Sorry.
Be careful with those Jupiter 8s. You might get lost in space.
I thought that was the Sputnik.
I'd actually say this. The Popularic, I've had both. Like, this used to be mine. I had a 7 that just basically fell apart. One huge advantage of the 7 or the Popularic compared to the 7, especially if you're using, let's say, super wide-angle lenses that need a viewfinder, the 7 does not have an accessory shoe in the usual place because it has this crummy meter. Whereas the Populaire has the accessory shoe exactly where it's supposed to be.
It's not recessed either. And you know what? That's one of the things I found with my Fed 2 is the cold shoe or accessory shoe, whatever you want to call it. It's actually recessed below the body, top of the camera. And trying to put a turret on this one for different lenses, it is a real pain because you actually have to have a specific one. Because I got
you need the actual Russian turret. Well,
that's the really crazy part is I got a 35 35 mil lens for this, which I'm not even going to get into. I'll save that for another episode. But it also had the viewfinder for it. Wouldn't fit. It would not fit. It was actually too shallow. It wouldn't fit on this camera at all.
Weird. I mean,
damn you Russians, get it right.
And finally, we're going back to Germany. And Trevor has the Voigtlander Besse R.
Yes, which is actually, at the time of manufacture, was being made by Cosina. So we're actually still
technically in Japan.
But they...
we're all communists, sort of.
Datavast.
Voigtlander Besse R was my introduction to rangefinders. I got it at a camera show, and I always wanted a rangefinder to try it out. And it comes with a 39 mil, Leica screw mount, and I got a wide range of lenses for it: the 25 Scopor, the 35 1.7. Oh, I don't remember which one it was, but
Ultron.
Ultron. You're right.
Do you still have this camera?
Unfortunately, I sold it.
Damn it! And you didn't sell it to me.
How much are you asking for it?
Yeah,
you were with me when I had my table, and you were off buying the 6.8 and selling your
kidney
51.2 to buy the 6.8.
You can only gas so much at the same time.
Exactly.
Yeah. If I only known you had an Ultron.
Yep.
Get out of my house.
I have one too.
I'm going to John's house. Somebody distract him.
But no, I do regret selling all of the Voigtlander stuff because I was getting into digital rangefinders, and that I was not using it as much as I should have, and that I ended up buying a Fuji something. Anyway,
FUG, Trevor.
Yes, I know. But I did use it for travel and street photography for multiple years while I had it. I had a wide range of lenses. I really enjoyed using it. I liked the ease of use. It did have a built-in light meter that was quite accurate. I think it was 60th of a second flash sync up to 1,000th bulb, up to 1,000th shutter speed. Don't think it was, well, it was through the lens metering sort of idea. But also, it was battery operated, so it could not be used manually. So no battery, no worky. So... and it was had a pop open gate style film back that was obviously easier to use than certain Leicas and older cameras that had the gate fold and the cut into the of the film leader and that sort of thing, which I didn't want to
curse
get into.
And swear and eventually just put the camera down and go to a different camera that
it's
easier loading.
But it did whet my appetite for rangefinders, and after that one I did have an R3A to go with the other lenses. That one was like a bad mount, so I'm not going to get into that because we're talking about 39 mil screw mounts.
Yep.
And my favorite lens that I had for that was a 1954 Taylor Hobson 51.5. And it was a non-coated lens, and I believe from what I read, it was basically a demo test for the Summicron 1.4.
What I have a feeling you don't have this lens anymore.
I don't. All the stuff I sold.
Why? It's Taylor Hobson.
I know. I look back now and go, oh, I was a dingbat. Why?
You're an idiot.
Yes, I know.
Yeah, that was my phrase. I just didn't want to word it that way.
You traded in for a Corvette?
No.
Two Corvettes?
I did get a fair amount.
Magic beans.
Magic beans.
Yes, which built this wonderful house I used to live in. But no. I got a decent price for it. But I was unfortunately, I waved back and forth between, film cameras that I'm not using and then, digital cameras that are easier to use that I can use professionally and then back and forth and that sort of thing. And I think of some of the stuff I've sold and it's like, oh. But anyway, back to 39 mil screw mounts. They're wonderful. I loved having a newer camera that I could put on a 60-year-old lens and get beautiful, results from.
Oh, yeah.
So,
yeah.
And there you go.
No. To go along with screw mounts, film, as we so love to say, keeps you humble. So... We've talked about screw mounts, so how about some screw ups?
Fuji.
And
all right,
we have probably done them all. I continue to do this.
Yeah.
Yes. Apparently, I can't tell Ektar and Portra 400 apart. So every time I load C41 film into my camera, I instantly forget what I've put in there.
Oh, jeez.
And it never fails. It's either I always screw them up. And I have done things like opened up a pack of Ektar and try to figure out, like, you know, which label I have left in my, you know, when you pull the tab off of a 120 roll and you stick them in your pocket, and I try to figure out which one was the one that I just stuck in my pocket.
Exactly.
Yeah. Luckily, those films are, you know, stand up to abuse very well. Yep. And so what I generally do when I do that is I throw them all into one tank, and then I just...
pray?
No, I leave them in for an extra 45 seconds and see what happens. And
generally, should we remind him that most cameras have an ISO dial of some sort?
Yeah, and then when you remember to use that and not screw up, it helps a lot too. But but generally when I do this, is, you know, rather than setting the ISO on the camera first and then loading the film, I like to do things the wrong way, so, you know, I do that.
I load first and then set the ISO.
Yeah. Yeah, and then there's the time when you always, you know, mislabel your chemical bottles, and then, you know, you go to New York City for the weekend, and you shoot a whole, you know, bunch of, like, 8 rolls, and then, you know, soup it in some Xtol that you had mixed up about 8.5 months ago and mislabeled by, you
At
know...
you didn't develop it in Fixer.
I'm a moron, not an idiot.
Well, speaking of that, I again had some of those nice big jugs for chemical that all look the same, and instead of grabbing my bottle of Fixer, I grabbed a bottle of DK50 and developed the film, stopped the film, and then developed them again in DK50. The results were interesting. I was able to, thanks to digital technology, my Epson V700 and Adobe Photoshop, was able to pull out some really odd images. It almost looked like I had tried to make the film's slides. And I actually had to switch the scanner to scan positive to actually get fun results. Would not recommend it, because I also exposed the film to light at the same time when it actually hadn't fixed.
So this wasn't a screw-up. This is an alternative photographic process.
Absolutely.
Through accidental means.
I've also used the wrong...
Lomography.
Yeah.
Lomography works.
I've also used sodium sulfate instead of anhydrous sodium sulfate to make D23, which blanks the film. And I messed up a roll of Cosmo Mono 100 and P30.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't screw up often, but when I do...
big time?
Well,
I don't always screw up film, but when I do, it's major.
I loved Kodak Plus X. I mourned when Kodak unceremoniously discontinued it. I hope one day it returns.
Well, they brought back T-Max 3200. I'm pretty sure Plus X probably isn't too far behind.
Well, a friend gifted me a roll, a 120 roll of Plus X, and I go, oh, goody. Loaded into my Rolleiflex. I was in the beaches, took what I thought was some great photos. And again, this is expired Plus X. I exposed around 80 ISO, you know, just to sort of... And I processed like I usually do, but the rinse, the water got too hot.
Melty.
And it melted.
Stained glass negatives, people.
Yeah. You know, it's not often that I choke on a tomato, but it almost came out my nose. Thanks, James.
Is that what they're calling it these days?
Yeah, so that's my one screw up. There's been another instance where I sort of accidentally underexposed Acros 100 by a stop, and well, I just push processed the puppy, and that's, you know, and it's just still came out great. But yeah, that Plus X roll, that still gets under my skin.
Yeah. Speaking of screw ups, I've had a minor one. I've had major ones, but let's start with a minor one first, and we'll get to the more fun ones later on. Needless to say, I forgot that I had pulled the spool out of my Bronica when I went up to Algonquin Park. And when you're up in the middle of nowhere, there's really nowhere to go to get a medium format spool. And
not
needless to say,
once you get outside of the GTA,
yeah, you're pretty much screwed.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm not going to sit there and whittle a piece of wood to hopefully work, but thankfully, a little bit of quick thinking, I had a jacket that I wrapped up a roll of Akros in, ripped the spool out, and thought, okay, I'll just work with it this way. So a little bit of a save there, but I mean, screw ups get worse and worse, and with the Akros, I had forgot that I had just loaded it, and then I didn't even realize that I had loaded Akros 100 and decided, oh, I'm going to expose this film for 400. What the hell? Thankfully, Akros is pretty lenient on exposure, and I did mark it that I did expose it for 400, and then I learned that Delta 3200 does not like long exposures beyond maybe a second.
Which that was, makes sense.
It was really unfortunate. It was some beautiful, beautiful scenery that I was trying to get. And yeah, it just didn't work with Delta 3200. No matter, I tried to push it to 64 so I could drop the exposure times. It didn't work. Didn't work at all. And then, you know, things just marginally get worse and worse from here. Like, you know, not paying attention to when you're pouring chemicals into your cylinders, and pre-wash turned out to be fixed. So not only did I pre-wash and fix, then I didn't even realize it was fixed, developed the film, stopped, fixed again, pulled it out, and thought, what did I do wrong? And
don't so process when you're high, people.
Hey, you know what?
Just say no to drugs. Just say no.
In my defense, although it's not defense, I wasn't stoned at the time. I was actually perfectly sober, and yet I still somehow managed to completely botch the film, which is, it's pretty sad. And then let's get into large format. And let's put it this way, as John likes to say about large format.
What do I like to say about large format? Oh, it's unforgiving. There are so many ways to fail, and it will kill you.
Yeah, that sounds
sort of
about
like that.
Yeah, I anybody that shoots large format, I'm pretty sure that they can probably come up with an entire list of the stupid stuff that they have done.
Left the lens open.
Triple exposed the same frame because you don't put the dark slide in the right way.
I've never done that.
I have.
I've never done that.
It's funny. You get these holders where it's double exposed on one side and clear on the other.
Yeah,
how
weird.
Does that happen?
Or lifting up the dark, or not, let me rephrase that. Lifting up the holder by the dark slide and realizing that you're trying to load your camera with just the dark slide in hand and thinking, shit.
No.
Oh, yeah.
No, I've
been there.
Most of mine is leaving the lens open when I pulled the dark slide.
Yeah, well, I had a really, really unfortunate experience. I just got this wonderful Cibachrome processor. I thought, fantastic. Finally, easy developing of 8x10. And 8x10 hurts when you screw up the film. And
especially
I had,
if it's color.
And mm-hmm. Yeah.
It hurts everywhere, especially where your wallet goes.
Well, this was a beautiful sheet of 8x10 Portra 160 VS. VS? No, is it VS or VC?
VC.
And I knew I had done everything right. Exposure, I had not screwed up by pulling the dark slide out and leaving my lens open. I actually have a list of things I do before I even pull the dark slide to make sure that doesn't happen, which still happens. And I forgot to rinse out my drum after I had blicks in it. So put the thing on, put it down on my Cibachrome roller, starts this little process with the pre-wash. Everything goes as smoothly as you can expect until I pulled the film out. And then I saw the streaks. Parts of the film completely gone. Why? Because I forgot to rinse the damn frickin' tube out from the blicks, and now I had parts of the emulsion that were just gone.
Again, say no to drugs. You were high that time, weren't you?
No. Maybe I should have been. Yeah, I probably maybe wouldn't have screwed up.
Well, I've had a couple of screw-ups. I was reminded of a time when I was following the campaign trail of a former prime minister for a newspaper, and John Chrétien was in town, and I went to a press rally of his and shot several rolls of film.
He beat your camera with Inuit statues, didn't he?
Were you the guy that got the pie in the face?
No, no. I wasn't at that one. Thank goodness. But due to the time-sensitive nature of it, raced back to the newsroom, developed film really quickly. We were using steel reels at the time. I quickly reeled everything, and I blew two of three rolls because I rolled it on too quickly, and they stuck together. And nothing worse than kind of going to your editor and saying, I have some shots. That might have been a better shot, but the film stuck together at that shot. But we've got these others, so that was a fun screw-up. Kind of a screw-up mechanically. I used to do graduation photography and would have assistants who would, because you'd be shooting film, so it's like, you know, you have multiple cameras, so it's like click, wind. You put down the two-finger count to let them know you have two frames left, and then they've preloaded a camera and then hand it to you, and you hand them the near-done one. So you don't miss a student, so on and so forth, during a graduation of like 600 people. So I hand him the camera, and I continue shooting. He starts rewinding it, and he's not that familiar with cameras and stuff, and he was a last-minute fill-in. And he rewound it so quickly that he unscrewed the rewind knob of an FE and then handed it back to me while I'm shooting, going, what do I do? And it's like, I don't have time to deal with this.
Well, the camera store is about three blocks that way. Start running.
During a graduation, you don't have time to do that, and you have to swap off cameras because you can't go, okay, hold on, graduation, I got to reload my film. So... Anyway, he ended up going, oh, wait, I think I can fix it. And he found a way that he could grab with his nails the screw and popped open the actual film back, thinking that it was going to work. And he just blew an entire roll of a graduation. So
someone's not getting paid.
Oh, yeah, no, he was canned right after that.
Well, no one's getting paid that day by the sounds of it.
Oh, my gosh. And we had to make note of what roll that was and what graduate to what graduate in the program were not going to get their photos so that we actually knew. Thank goodness we're digital now for things like this because you know, you don't have to just keep shooting sort of thing. But graduations.
Cut that. He said, thank you for digital. Cut that.
For jobs like that, that is. So, but those are two kind of screw ups when it came to film.
And I have a somewhat different kind of screw up. And this is definitely digital. So bear with me. You might think you're a dedicated listener of this show. You might think you've heard every single episode.
But you never heard episode zero.
Episode zero. Remember the first time we got together to shoot record the first show?
Yep.
And I have a very old Zoom H4 digital recorder. The first model, it's about 10, 11 years old now, has a really lousy user interface. Even back then, people had said the ergonomics were just horrible on it. And I thought I was recording the first episode. And this is the same kind of feeling, Trevor, when you realize that you have effed up big time and there is no way to fix. And I realized that for the entire first episode, the recorder was effectively in pause. So I just curled up under the table and started weeping silently while these guys started kicking me. And we had to record the episode all over again. There are some times, and we've had some other adventures from time to time that you don't know about because we can fix them behind the scenes.
Absolutely.
But this one, nope. The episode zero, it's off. It exists in some other alternate universe where I did hit the button properly. But that was my major screw-up.
But, I mean, in the end, what you heard as episode one was a much stronger episode than what it would have been initially. That's
what I tell myself. It was just a dress rehearsal because we were after quality.
Well, that's about it for this episode. My name's Alex Oakes, and remember, kids, mount first, then screw.
What the hell? Where did that come from?
Wow.
I'm at a loss for words.
Okay, James, I'm sorry. The whiny, diny, 6x9 me, he kicked your ass,
he did.
Man.
He did. He screwed me in the ass.
And there was no dinner and movie beforehand.
I feel screwed. And I
to the point.
And you know when you're really screwed? I gave him a drink. I bought him the drink.
Definitely not a cheap date.
Wow.
Do you mention your names?
Who are you and what have you done with Alex Laux? Anyway, this is James Lee. Stop screwing around and get out there and shoot some film.
I'm Mike Bataxi, and if you're rewinding with your knob, you're doing it wrong.
This is Donna Bataxi.
And she's looking for Mike's knob.
Come on now!
Macro lens required.
This is Trevor Black. Just remember, just do it one shot at a time.
Screw you, man!
And this is Bill Smith. Remember, develop, stop, fix, not fix, stop, develop.
Nice and easy.
This is John Meadows, looking at that Yashica YF. Who says you can't get a cheap bottom?
Oh my god!
So screw from the bottom up?
We all need a drink now.
We might have had too much to drink.
Oh dear. Did we get everyone? I think we got
everyone.